This is Pat's Private Eye. I'm not here right now. Please leave a message.
Punt, Tracy, got a little something for you, but this is not for the faint-hearted. It's an unsolved murder. Very nasty. Happened during the war in a place called Lower Quinton. But if you're of a fragile disposition and afraid of the dark side, then think twice before agreeing to accept this unusual case.
I don't know why he's briefing me. It sounds more like a case for Detective Chief Superintendent Christopher Foyle, he of Foyle's War. Beyond the wartime setting, Tracy gave me few details, but putting murder and Lower Quinton into a web search was enough to throw up an unexpected first lead. Someone's written a song.
Well, spring had come early, that Valentine's Day.
The lyrics tell the story of the rather gruesome slaying of a farm labourer called Charles Walton, killed with his own implements in a lonely field in February 1945.
In the town of Lower Quinton, he watched the first buds grow, and with his pitchfork and his slash hook, off a hedge he did go.
Hello?
Oh, hi, is that Jack?
Yeah.
Hello, hi, I'm Steve Punch. Jack Blackman is a student. So how does he know about this story? I'm trying to find out about the Charles Walton case, and I came across a song that you wrote on the internet, and I'm interested in how you found out about the story, where you know the story from.
Well, I heard about it from my dad, who used to teach in Lower Quinton, which is where the murder happened. Yeah, he just sort of heard about it from the locals and people around there.
Jack says he can't help much more and suggests I talk to the locals. But he also says that all these years later, they still don't like strangers asking about the murder. But ask, I must. After a few fruitless phone calls, I'm beginning to see what he means. The postmistress says it would be bad for business. The landlady of the pub knows nothing. No one wants to talk about a murder 7 decades ago. Perhaps because the main suspect was a local. In fact, the very farmer on whose land it happened. It's time to set the sat-nav for Lower Quinton, where at first, it looks like not much has changed. So, after winding our way here, we are in Lower Quinton. Please drive slowly through our village. But quickly, the 21st century is apparent.
Hair, beauty and holistics.
I was expecting Detective Foyle territory here. But to be honest, this looks more like Miss Marple. I haven't brought headscarf or handbag, so all I can do to emulate the doughty senior citizen sleuth is adopt the doughtiness. She wouldn't take no for an answer, and neither must I.
Hello, excuse me, sorry. Have you heard of Charles Walton at all?
Yeah.
Ah, she seems like she might talk.
Do you know anything about it?
Well, only the murder on me and him.
She doesn't sound too keen on talking, and neither did anyone else.
Yeah. I can't say any more.
No, just that's lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I kept thanking people for saying nothing. I was getting nowhere, holistically. But then, a breakthrough. One lady says she's happy to talk. And she is. But only about how the BBC is too left-wing, and could I please just not make the programme at all. Listener feedback is always welcome, but not enormously useful in this instance, so I did what you should always do if you want to know something in a village. I went to the pub, where a very friendly lady with a nice smile seemed hopeful.
Well, it was a long time ago, but a lot of people don't really like talking about it.
Oh, there must be somebody, surely.
Mick might know more about it.
Aha! I arranged to talk to Mick later. In the meantime, she suggests I go to nearby Stratford-on-Avon and visit the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust. I'm about to explain that I'm not a tourist when she explains that they have a local newspaper archive there, where I can see how the story was reported at the time.
So here we've got the collections of the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust. So we've got
a helpful assistant leads me into the library with lots and lots of Bard-related books and big folders of local newspapers.
Here, this is the Stratford-upon-Avon Herald for, let's have a look, Friday the February 16th, 1945.
She produces a folder of editions from late on during the war, and I'm plunged into the fascinating world of World War II seen from a local perspective.
Nazi plans to invade the US are in possession of Stratford, man. That's interesting.
Was this an overlooked motive? Did someone local stumble across Hitler's plans for an American invasion? It turns out I'm not familiar with 1940s typography.
Invade us. I was going to say, I thought that was a massive story.
It's a mistake Miss Marple could easily have made if she'd forgotten her glasses and was suddenly much less clever. Moving swiftly on, I find what I'm looking for, and things get serious.
On Wednesday night, following a search, the body of a 74-year-old farm labourer, Mr. Charles Walton of Lower Quinton, was found with terrible injuries in a field on Meon Hill, where he had been engaged in hedge laying. A trouncing hook and a two-tined pitchfork are said to have been embedded in his body. Ooh. Mr. Walton, who lived with his niece, was a frail old man. He suffered considerably from rheumatism and walked with the aid of two sticks. However, he still did odd jobs for local farmers, and on Wednesday morning set off for work at the hill grounds, a lonely spot about a mile from his home.
The library assistant, still being helpful, hands me a copy of a book called Warwickshire Murders by one Betty Smith. After reading her account of the case, I track down her contact details and ask if I can meet her. This was an unusually brutal murder, in which a pitchfork had been used to pin the 74-year-old Charles Walton to the ground. It was quickly decided to bring in Scotland Yard, and one of their finest detectives, Robert Fabian, was assigned to the case. He later became known as Fabian of the Yard, and was played on television in the 1950s, becoming the first real-life TV detective hero. In writing about the case, he mentions a black dog, feared by locals as a harbinger of death, which seems a bit far-fetched. But as I head back to Lower Quinton...
Oh, yeah, there are dogs. Okay, let's go.
It's time to meet Mick, who remembers growing up in the shadow of the murder.
When I was a lad, we used to go up on Main Hill and play, and I remember on St Valentine's Day, all these policemen walking over the hill, inspecting it. We used to know the exact spot where Charlie Walton was murdered. It was a very small village in them days, a sort of one-horse town, off the beaten track, no direct road to anywhere, and a very close society. And when the police came, the doors were slammed in their faces. Nobody wanted to talk about it, and still don't. Even the older fellas in the village will keep quiet about it. They couldn't get anything out of anybody.
But didn't the celebrated detective Fabian of the Yard manage to charm the locals?
No, everybody in the village hated this Fabian chap. He got threatening letters of what people were going to do to him and his family and his daughter, and real horrible stuff. They didn't want to know him, they hated him.
Routine, detail, science and tenacity. These are the weapons used by squads of highly trained men. Men like former Inspector Robert Fabian, hailed by the press as one of England's greatest detectives.
All of these people are murderers. These are what we call death masks.
I'm quite excited, actually, because this museum's not open to the public.
It's not open to the public. Its main purpose is to educate police officers, so most of the people come into the museum...
Perhaps excited is an inappropriate word, but not many people get to see Scotland Yard's crime museum, where real-life detectives come during training. I'm here to find out more about Fabian. But first, my guide, Paul Bickley, points out a few wartime crimes, and in particular the blackout murders of 1942. They didn't involve a pitchfork, but something even more horribly mundane.
The murder appears to be motivated by sex. He mutilated her body with the can opener you can see there. He strangled her and mutilated her with the weapons that you can see there. Very much like Jack the Ripper.
Blitz spirit aside, it seems the war brought little let up in the horrors that the museum records. I can understand why it's not open to the public. It's getting to me already. I ask about the yard's famous son, Fabian. And rather disconcertingly, Paul opens a drawer.
Pull the drawer open.
It's not his head, is it?
This is your man here, Mr. Superintendent Fabian. Fabian of the yard, as we like to call him.
No, it was some photographs.
And this particular case is about the murder of a man called Alec the Antiquist. It was an armed robbery in a place called Jay's Jewellers in Charlotte Street, Central...
I learned a great deal about Fabian. He was a very successful detective who worked methodically through all the evidence using the very latest techniques until he found his quarry. Or as he put it himself...
Police science and routine police work make it increasingly difficult for the so-called invisible killer to escape.
Except in rural Warwickshire, where the invisible killer stayed stubbornly invisible. Police science and routine police work both failed to produce a result, and Fabian found the locals uncooperative to a level he couldn't fathom. He wrote in his memoirs,
"We took 4,000 statements, traced tinkers and gypsies. We sent 29 samples of clothing and hair to the Birmingham laboratory for analysis. I had tramps detained in Somerset and boot repairers questioned in Salisbury, but the murder still remained unsolved. One night, when I'd waited all day to question a witness, he said, 'He's been dead and buried a month now. What are you worrying about?' Then he shut his door."
He's been dead and buried 68 years now, and the door's still shut. It's time to go and meet Betty Smith, ex-journalist and Warwickshire's own Miss Marple. She's made a detailed study of the case and tells me to come and pick her up from her house. When I get there, she immediately puts me properly in my place.
Morning. Hi, Steve.
Steve what?
Steve Punt.
Oh, what's he for?
I'll be asking you the questions. And...
Will you? Good.
Yeah.
Well, that's me told. She also has a checkered track record with cars.
I've been through the windscreen.
I resolve to drive as safely as possible. Given her previous experience with a windscreen, I nervously fumble the rear seatbelt firmly into place and we head towards a Roman road, where Betty offers an interesting theory.
This is the Foss.
I thought so. Yeah.
This is the Foss.
The Foss way, yeah.
Haunted it is.
Is it? Who by?
A troop of Roman soldiers.
I hadn't heard that the Foss Way was haunted by a troop of Roman soldiers, but there's even a convincing detail.
Only you don't see below the knees because the road has been surfaced so many times they puddle along.
The spectral legionnaires march on the level of the original road, and 20 centuries of resurfacing work means you can't see them below the knee. What an image that is.
That sounds like a particularly spectacular ghost to an entire Roman legion.
Betty was full of local lore. Spooky Romans with invisible feet being only the half of it. The area is full of legend and folktale, which an outsider wouldn't know. In fact, as we search for a way up to the murder site on Meon Hill, my status as a town-dwelling stranger becomes all too obvious.
This doesn't look like there's any right of way there. There must be a footpath somewhere.
Why? Why must there be?
Good point.
I have literally lost my bearings, but fortunately, Betty has come prepared. Like Miss Marple, she has done her homework.
I have here an old map.
Is it an Ordnance Survey map? Oh, right. Yes. Thank you.
We get as close as we can to the scene, and by now, I'm on my way to losing the power of speech.
So, what... Let me think how to phrase this.
Betty looks at me expectantly. Having confidently told her I'm going to be asking her questions, I finally do.
So the body was found just up there by a hedge. What appeared to have happened?
His niece, who kept house for him,
right,
had left his food out at 4 o'clock, as was custom always, and she could not understand why he didn't come in to have his evening meal. Hmm. So she got the neighbour next door, who was a Mr. Beasley, asked him if he would accompany her up and see if they could find him. She thought
the niece and Mr. Really. Beasley, yeah, then went to the farmer, Alfred Potter.
They went to the farmer, and he said...
And the three of them went to look for the missing man.
They found Charles Walton with all sorts of wounds upon him and lying flat under the willow tree.
At that point, Potter tried to pull out the hook left in Walton's body, thus leaving his fingerprints on it, in view of two witnesses. A death on Valentine's Day, under a willow tree, involving a hook and a pitchfork. What could it possibly mean?
Witchcraft.
Sorry, Betty?
It gave rise to witchcraft.
To rumours of witchcraft, anyway. Suddenly, the black dogs and ghostly gladiators make sense. Betty told me that tales of dark magic have surrounded the case since its earliest days, when Fabian, also a townie who assumed there'd be a path through the case, was supposedly taken aside by a local officer and acquainted with a tale of the supposed nearby killing of a witch in Victorian times. By the 1970s, TV reporter Michael Bakewell was offering viewers this level-headed theory.
Walton himself was a witch, and he'd made barren the local land. He is said to have tied a toy plough to the leg of a pet toad and sent it scurrying across the local fields.
This aspect of the case has always proved media-friendly, and rumours abounded of a cross carved into his chest and that the witch murdered nearby in 1875 had been pinned to the ground with a pitchfork, just like Walton.
Well, beneath an old willow tree, his body they found. Through the nick his own pitchfork, it pinned him to the ground. The police could find no motive, the detective at a loss. But that cut across his chest was in the shape of a cross.
Betty says there are all sorts of stories about witches in Warwickshire, and local boy Will Shakespeare almost certainly knew of them.
That big stone over the road.
Yeah.
A witch appeared and said, "If Long Compton thou can see, King of England shalt thou be."
Witches warning someone they will become king. It sounds familiar. But the 17th century is one thing. Were these beliefs still going round during the Second World War? Professor Malcolm Gaskill, a leading expert on the history of witchcraft in the UK, points out that the year before the murder, there was a high-profile witchcraft trial, and that rumours of the occult were very much in the air.
There's a famous case in 1944 against a spiritualist medium called Helen Duncan, where they used the Witchcraft Act, and that's the 1735 Act. It's not been used for, you know, at least 150 years.
Yes. And are there other instances during World War II of cases which involved witchcraft in some way?
Well, there are. I mean, there are various characters, and there's this whole cast of pagan occultists who claim they have some sort of involvement in the war effort. So, for example, this guy Cecil Williamson, he claims MI6 asked him to set up the Witchcraft Research Centre. Now, he's a bit of an unreliable witness, but there probably is some kind of interest within MI5, MI6, in particularly the fact that the Nazis are interested in occult beliefs.
So the Nazis believed in witchcraft, but did Scotland Yard? Did they think this terrible crime was the result of tying toys to the legs of toads? They had a rather different theory. Betty takes me to a housing estate on the edge of the village, built on land which in 1945 was a prisoner of war camp with over 1,000 inmates. Fabian suspected one particular Italian prisoner.
He was found crouching in a ditch with bloodstains, and Fabian thought, well, hey, I've got him, you see.
Betty's right, and according to his memoirs, Fabian thought he had solved the case.
We found a swarthy Italian scrubbing blood from his coat. We sped the suspect's blood-stained coat off to the Birmingham laboratory with samples of the victim's blood for a match. Witchcraft murder, I said to Sergeant Webb. Really?
Once again, Fabian was foiled, and this time it was the evidence that wouldn't cooperate. The bloodstains actually proved the swarthy Italian innocent.
He was poaching rabbits, and the blood on him was rabbit blood.
Right.
He didn't want anyone to know about the rabbits, because he didn't want anyone to know he'd found a way to get out of camp.
So he was almost prepared to be put in the frame for a murder rather than let on.
Well, as soon as it became obvious to him, he did fess up and everything was all right. Obviously, he'd got nothing whatever to do with it.
No.
Fabian of the Yard eliminated the rabbit-poaching Italian. He tracked down his tinkers and gypsies. He listened to the tales of Walton the Witch. But it was Walton's watch they were more interested in. It was missing from his pocket and was the one thing that suggested robbery might have been the motive and that a stranger might be the culprit. But were they? Who else is left? Who could it be?
Hello?
Oh, hello. Is that David Wilson?
Yes.
Back at my hotel, I'm calling David Wilson, a leading criminologist who advises me not to chase the scurrying toad of rumour, but instead to concentrate on the facts.
There has always been a tendency to blame an other, some person that's going to come into the community and commit the crime. There's always a tendency to say it must be those Italians in the prisoner of war camp, or words to those effect, or this is so inexplicable, so extraordinary, it must be as a result of witchcraft. By and large, murderers and their victims know each other and live in cheek by jowl with each other. There were some 550 murders in 2012. I wonder, Steve, if you could hazard a guess what percentage of those 550 got cleared up.
60 to 70%.
It was actually 92%.
Wow.
And it was 92%, a figure which has remained stable for literally decades. It was 92% because you don't have to be Inspector Morse or Cracker to work out who done it, because who does it is somebody who is known to the victim and usually a member of their extended family or network of friends or acquaintances. And on this occasion, I'm sure that was the case too.
Handily, I am not Inspector Morse or Cracker, so I was heartened by that. I decide to go back to the evidence. Fabian's original notes on the case are in the National Archives, and they show that he looked very closely at a man who Walton knew very well, his employer Alfred Potter, manager of the Furze Farm. Walton was working for him on the day he died.
When first seen by the police, Mr. Potter said, after feeding the cattle, he went to get a heifer out of a ditch. Now he told a different story. Yeah, he was asked if he touched the body. He said no. But in satisfying himself the old man was dead, he caught hold of the trouncing hook.
Aha! I remembered that Potter had touched the trouncing hook right in front of Mr. Beasley and Potter's niece. Had he cleverly made sure he had an explanation for his fingerprints being on the murder weapon? And what about the missing watch? Had it been taken to give the appearance of robbery? If so, where was it?
Hello?
Hello, is that Graham Potter?
Yes.
Oh, hi. My name's Steve.
Alfred Potter's grandson still lives locally, and I wanted to know if Alfred had ever talked to his family about the murder.
I mean, I just wanted to ask you about your grandfather. I mean, he was one of two people who made a rather gruesome discovery, and I just wondered whether he ever talked about it to you or ever mentioned it.
He was dead before I was born, so he wasn't likely to.
Oh, I see. Beyond that, you don't know anything about the story at all?
No, not really, no.
With no real evidence and absolutely no apparent motive, no charges were ever brought. Years later, the watch was reportedly found in an outbuilding. Had Walton never been wearing it that day? Or had it been replaced by the thief? The case is one of that 8% of murders that are unsolved. I asked criminologist David Wilson for his thoughts.
If you stick with the numbers, if you stick with the basic principles, the overwhelming likelihood is that Charles Walton was killed by somebody in the local community. But what is more interesting to me as a criminologist is why his killer wasn't caught. And I think that failure of Fabian of the Yard to catch this particular man is because he seems to have been stuck with a motive. He seems to have been stuck with, you know, well, why would Alfred Potter have wanted to have killed Charles Walton? And because he couldn't come up with any convincing motive, it seemed to me that Potter was incredibly lucky in escaping the full force of the law.
In my report back to Tracy, I remember my Miss Marple and try to bring all the suspects together. The strangers that were never traced. The blood-stained prisoner of war who turned out to be after some off-ration rabbit pie. The farmer who changed his story about leaving his prints on the murder weapon. And the rumours of witchcraft. Fabian of the Yard had a curious change of heart about this supernatural element. In his autobiography, written in the 1950s, he calls it a witchcraft murder and tells us,
"A black dog came running down Meon Hill, and a moment later a farm lad followed. 'Looking for a dog, son?' I said. He went pale."
Fabian claims he saw a black dog with his own eyes. But in his 1945 case notes in the National Archives, there is no mention of black dogs or witches. The autopsy records make no mention of any cross carved on Walton's chest, and the supposed witch who had died years earlier was not pinned to the ground with a pitchfork. It could be that Fabian just knew a good eye-catching angle once he was retired and selling books rather than solving crimes.
Here we are. See where he's
Charles Walton's grave is not marked, but just opposite the church is his old cottage, where I stand and muse.
Very pretty, beamed, thatched cottage here. It's under offer. Someone's buying it. Very pretty, though.
I wonder if that someone knows who used to live there.
So, there is a definite touch of Miss Marple about the fact that it seems very strange that such a horrible thing could have happened in such a pretty little place.
And then I drive out of the village, confident that whatever lay behind this singular case, it wasn't witchcraft. But still, keeping a wary eye open for a black dog.
So was old Charles Walton part of something more? And he killed in suspicion of what he did or saw. And though this was long ago, are we really beyond that? When the need for justice overcomes that old fact.